And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Katie Weaver. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Officials in American cities are raising concerns that new federal money to expand high-speed internet services may favor rural areas. Leaders in cities say the rule could hurt some urban communities that also want financial help to upgrade their internet services. The money is part of a $350 billion government aid program for state and local governments to help them recover from the coronavirus crisis. The U.S. Treasury Department approved use of the aid for expanding and improving high-speed internet services. But a government rule sets eligibility requirements based on internet speeds. To receive assistance, communities must have internet upload speeds below 25 megabits per second, or MBPS, and download speeds under 3 MBPS. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission defines high-speed internet, also known as broadband, as being above these speeds. The Treasury rule is aimed at providing financing to remote rural areas that have slow or no internet service. But officials in cities believe the eligibility requirements do not pay attention to their internet needs. They say that although city areas have broadband available, internet speeds may not be fast enough to meet local demands. For example, some broadband speeds in cities might not be fast enough to permit a whole family to work, study, and watch video at the same time, these officials say. Such a need became very common in U.S. households during the coronavirus pandemic. Detta Kissel is a retired Treasury Department lawyer who used to write agency rules. She now works on efforts to expand broadband services in her community in Arlington, Virginia. Kissel told the Associated Press the rule is basically prioritizing those rural areas over the underserved urban areas where there is more population. Several cities have urged the Treasury Department to change the rule. The cities include Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and San Antonio, Texas. Some officials want the government to define underserved areas as places with internet download and upload speeds below 100 Mbps. One study suggests that by changing the definition of high-speed internet, 82 million households and businesses, instead of 11 million, would see gains from the aid. The study was carried out for America's Communications Association, which represents small and medium-sized Internet providers. If the Treasury Department goes forward with its rule as proposed, Internet speeds in some rural areas currently lacking broadband could jump ahead of some city areas. That possibility has been criticized by some mayors. The inner city of Memphis is as in a dire need of broadband connection as rural Tennessee, said Memphis Mayor Jim Strickland. In Milwaukee, people already have at least one Internet provider offering download speeds of 25 Mbps and upload speeds of 3 Mbps. But in some parts of the city, fewer than half the households have Internet service because of the cost, said David Hankey, the city's chief information officer. If you don't have a job and you can't afford broadband, that's kind of a cycle, Hankey said. You're locked out of remote learning, remote work, telemedicine, and participating basically in a modern society. Broadband industry groups have urged the Treasury Department to keep to its plan to provide money to areas with the slowest Internet speeds. Although the public comment period ended in July, the Treasury has set no date to publish the rule's final version. A Treasury official said the process of examining the comments is likely to continue into the fall. I'm Brian Lynn.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, declared the coronavirus crisis a pandemic on March 11th of 2020. The WHO's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said that day, "Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly." He was reminding people that the word is used only for the most extreme and dangerous spreads of disease. Since the start of the pandemic, Johns Hopkins University reports, there have been more than 228 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 among the almost 8 billion people on the planet. The number of deaths from the disease is about 4.7 million. At the same time, new versions or variants of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19 are developing and spreading very fast. In the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, said the Delta variant is the main cause of new COVID infections. Governments and health officials around the world reacted to the crisis by establishing the largest vaccination program in history. Data collected by the Bloomberg Company shows that by September, more than 5.9 billion shots of vaccine have been administered to people across 184 countries. Many scientists, however, believe that the new coronavirus is here to stay. The science publication Nature recently reported the results of a poll it did with more than 100 scientists. 89% said they believed SARS-CoV-2 virus will become endemic, meaning it will continue to exist in some areas for years to come. Michael Osterholm is an expert on epidemics at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. He told Nature that ending the existence of the virus right now is unrealistic. He compared it to trying to build a stepping stone pathway to the moon. The World Health Organization defines pandemics, epidemics, and endemics based on a disease's rate of spread. For example, the Ebola outbreak that spread within West African countries from 2014 to 2016 was called an epidemic. In 2016, the World Health Agency declared that the Zika virus was a public health emergency of international concern. The insects called mosquitoes pass the disease to humans when they bite them. Zika was first discovered in Africa and Asia before spreading to Brazil and other South American countries. Some considered Zika an epidemic, while others view it as a pandemic, like the current coronavirus health crisis. The difference between an epidemic and a pandemic is not in the severity of the disease, but the degree to which it has spread. A pandemic means a disease has spread to several countries around the world. Epidemic is used to mean disease spreads in smaller areas. Researchers from Columbia University's School of Public Health wrote, "While an epidemic is large, it is also generally contained or expected in its spread, while a pandemic is international and out of control." The word endemic came from the Greek word endemos, meaning in the population. In public health, it is used to describe a disease outbreak that is present and limited to an area. This makes the disease spread and rates easier to control. Malaria, for example, is considered endemic in many warm, wet areas across countries in Asia, Africa, and South America. The H1N1 influenza virus is also endemic. More than one-third of the scientists Nature polled thought it would be possible to end the COVID-19 pandemic from some countries while it continued to exist in others. Christopher Dye studies epidemics at Britain's University of Oxford. He said, "I guess COVID will be eliminated from some countries, but with a continuing and maybe seasonal risk of reintroduction from places where vaccine coverage and public health measures have not been good enough." Laura Herrero and Eugene Madzukir are researchers from Australia's Griffith University. They wrote about the disease in the online news site, The Conversation. The scientists said that with face coverings and vaccination, the COVID-19 pandemic could disappear like smallpox or polio did. But they said the disease could also become endemic over time. They said viruses are more likely to become endemic if they are adapted to a local environment of people with low or zero immunity. And vaccination rates will affect the progress of the disease. A low vaccine rate could permit the virus to continue at an epidemic level for longer, they wrote. I'm Katie Weaver.
We'll be right back. From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking. relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well-respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Merry says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Merry says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Merry says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Merry says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served two terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served two terms. Robert Merry says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only one term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting 8.
And I suspect that he was probably right. And given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters JKP, the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as 4 more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had 2 choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.